Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. John Perkins spoke in Seattle on April 7, 2011. Many of us admire Perkins through his 2004 book on geopolitics, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He has a new book out on global finance called Hoodwinked. Surprisingly, in Seattle he said little about finance and much about the subjects of some much earlier books. Indigenous cultures, shamanism, and prophecies of ancient civilizations and of obscure indigenous cultures that seem to be heralding the birth of a new age of compassion. If only we can all work together as midwives. It's an odd mix of mysticism, prophecy, ethnography, personal narrative, hard-nosed critical economic analysis, and maybe some wishful thinking about how consumers can change the world. I've whittled down Perkins's 50-minute talk to 22 minutes, and we'll skip a lot of the prophecies. He begins by telling comic stories of his experiences in the Peace Corps in the late 60s, among the Shuar people of the Amazon Valley in Ecuador. Here he nearly died, and his life was saved by what some might call a witch doctor, a shaman, through an induced transcendental experience he calls shapeshifting. Decades later, he wrote a book about such arts, titled Shapeshifting. Still later, he happened to run into the Dalai Lama, who happened to be reading the very book at the time. Either Perkins is the greatest liar since Bernie Madoff, or else he's had some unlikely but real experiences, and from them derived some valuable insights. Personally, I believe him. Let's start with that Peace Corps stint in the Amazon. Here's John Perkins.
And then they sent me to Ecuador. Next thing I know, I'm on this rickety old wooden bus for 2 days, going up over the Andes and down to the end of the road to the Amazon. I'm going to be sent deep into the Amazon. It actually requested it. And so I'm on this rickety old bus that's filled with chickens and goats and pigs and people and babies, and every living creature on that bus was vomiting for most of those 2 days, including me. Especially me. Finally, at the end of 2 days, we get to the end of the road. We're in the Amazon. I now got a 2-day walk to the site where I'm supposed to spend the next 2 years. So as I'm walking in, I figured there's people walking out, and I figured this is a good time for me to practice my Spanish. And to my chagrin, I discovered that the people walking out don't speak Spanish. They're Shuar, indigenous people. They speak Shuar. My first experience with U.S. government work, teach me another language for 8 weeks and send me to people that don't speak that language. How many of you have ever seen a shrunken head or a picture of one? Oh, good. Well, that's the Shuar did it. They're the only people, they're headhunters around the world, but the Shuar are the preeminent head shrinkers today. And so I'm on my way in to spend the next 2 years with the Shuar. So I'm really going through a very traumatic experience. I joined the Peace Corps because I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I didn't believe in Vietnam. But believe me, as I'm walking for 2 days in this jungle, feeling very homesick, crying the whole time, nobody can tell because it's the rainforest, you know, it's raining. I'm going in there and I'm thinking, damn, I wish I'd gone to Vietnam. People speak English there. Finally, I get to the site where I'm going to spend the next 2 years, and there's one guy there who speaks English. I mean, excuse me, Spanish. He's the school teacher. He's from up in the Andes, speaks Spanish. But he doesn't really believe that I speak Spanish. He maintains that I don't. He says he can understand me, but he's not quite sure what language I'm speaking. So I tell him, as I arrive there, he greets me, and I say, so here I am to help you guys form your credit and savings co-ops. He looks around and he says, credit and savings? We don't have any money here. Money doesn't last in the Amazon anyway, and plus it's all barter here, you know. You're guinea pig for my bananas. And it was very much at that time that I get the message, you know. I got nothing to teach these people, but man, do they have a lot to teach me. And then I get very ill. I lost probably 35, 40 pounds in a week. Hey, I'll sell you that diet. I was dying, and I couldn't get out. A two-day walk, two-day bus ride. There was no way I could get back to the doctors in the Andes. I was resigned to dying. And then late one afternoon, the school teacher comes up to me, and he's leading this decrepit-looking old schwa man by the hand. And he says, "This guy is the shaman. He can cure you." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, right. Like, I'm from New Hampshire. Give me another one." And the guy looks, the old man looks at me, and I can cure you. You know, this is all being translated. So what the heck? I figure, well, what do I got to lose? So this old man, he steps back, and he looks at my feet, and he looks up my body, up to my head, and he looks me up and down, and he stands up real close to me. He's a lot shorter than me. He looks up, and he says, "You're dying." And that's good, because the Schwa believe in reincarnation, and he figured my life was about as bad as it could possibly get. Time to move on to the next one. So I think at that point I started crying once again, and he says, "Oh, well, maybe you're not ready, in which case I can cure you tonight. I can shape-shift you out of this." The title of one of my books, "I Can Shape-Shift You Out of This." So I said, "I think I'll take that," and he did. That night, he did a classic shamanic ceremony on me. The details are in the book, Shapeshifting. But to make a long story short, it was an incredible experience. We couldn't talk or anything. He played music, and I went through this vision quest all night long. And what I saw was that my parents brought me up to be very, very hygienic. New Hampshire, Yankee, Calvinist. We only ate meat and potatoes. You didn't eat onions. You didn't eat garlic. My wife's in the audience. She remembers my parents. They never did eat garlic or onions. You know, nothing like that. You washed your hands about 500 times a day. Very hygienic. Well, now I'm living with the Schwa. And the Schwa have a very different concept of life. Their most popular food is something, it's a kind of beer called chicha. It's made by the women chewing a manioc root and spitting it. Some of you, I think, have been with the Achwa. Are there anybody in the audience that's been there? Yes, you've had chicha. Isn't that wonderful? So the Amazonian people don't drink the water in the rivers because it's polluted by organic matter. But they drink a lot of chicha because you got to rehydrate. That's the only thing they drink, the spit beer. And you eat these strange things, too. Like you reach inside an old rotting log and pull out a handful of squirming grubs, wait, grubs, and eat them live. Very nutritious. But you know, I ate all these things and drank the beer because there weren't any Cliff Bars available. But every time I saw on this journey that every time I ate these things and drank this beer, my mom was standing over my shoulder saying, "Son, it'll kill you." And on this journey that night, I saw that the Schwa are some of the healthiest people I'd ever met. The men are all built like Rambo, right? And the women are pregnant, they're very, very sexy, they're very fertile. People live to be very old. They're hunters and gatherers, so they die sometimes in dugout canoe accidents, tipping over, snake bite. But if they don't die from an accident, they live to be very old. So on that night, I saw that what was killing me was not the food. It was a mindset that had been instilled in me. And that night, I changed my mindset. And the next morning, I woke up and I was fine. I fell in love with these people, the Schwa. I spent 3 years in the Peace Corps there. I was in the Peace Corps for 2 years. I spent 3 years. I would have extended more than 3 years if they'd let me, but they wouldn't. I go back a lot now. I have three godchildren there. And it was a profound experience. Mindset. And I tell this story because that's where we are today, I think. We must have a mindset change. If we want to survive as a species, we are at this revolutionary time. We must shapeshift. We are at a time when what we do know is that the world we've created is a failure. The economic system we've created is a failure. I'm an economist by training. Less than 5% of us live here in the United States. We consume more than 25% of the world's resources. While roughly half the world, 3 billion people, are starving to death and are on the verge of starvation. That is a failed system. There's no other way to describe it. It's not a model. You can't sell it to the Africans, the Indians, the Chinese, the Latin Americans. You need another five or six planets just like this one without people to do that. And despite Avatar, it ain't happening. We've got to fix it. We're in an extremely fragile space station. But unlike the one our astronauts built, this one doesn't have any shuttles. We can't get off. We've got to fix it. In every one of these prophecies, another one, I'll say one more, in Tibet, well, I had the exceptional good fortune a few years ago of being in an airport with 30 people. I was leading a group up in Ladakh, Little Tibet, out of Indian Protectorate. They used to be part of Tibet. I was in this airport getting ready to fly from Leh Ladakh to Jammu, India, and the Dalai Lama and his entourage come waltzing through. And they're going to get on the same flight, and the Dalai Lama is carrying my book, Shapeshifting. So somebody in our group goes up to his secretary and says, "Do you know the author of this book's on this flight?" Make a long story short, I end up, the Dalai Lama invites me to sit with him in the front seat of the airplane for this whole flight. So we're sitting here talking, and I asked him, I said, "Your Holiness, do you know that the prophecies say that the 14th Dalai Lama, you, will be the last? What do you think of that?" And he said, "Well, you know, I think I'll be the last maybe from the Himalayas. Maybe I'll be the last Buddhist Dalai Lama." That blew my mind. And I said, "Well, do you know where the next one will be from? And he said, "I'm not sure, but I think it'll be from either the Andes or the Amazon. That's why I'm reading your book." As a result of that time we spent together, he invited our whole group of 30 people to his home in Dharamsala several days later to spend an afternoon with him in his living room. And it was enlightening. Lightning, that's a good word to use. It was enlightening because, well, it was enlightening for many reasons. He said a lot of things, but I was really struck by when he first walked into the room, he welcomed us, and then he said, "I just want to say, don't become a Buddhist. The world doesn't need any more Buddhists. But do practice the Buddhist principles of compassion and love." And that hit me like, okay, so this is what he meant about being from South America, where these Andes and Andean people are not Buddhists, and that kind of blew my mind. But what he was really saying is the next leader needs to be someone who believes in compassion and love and doesn't necessarily have to know all the mantras and all the other things that Buddhist scholars are brought up to believe in. It was fascinating to hear him say that. But here's this another prophecy, the prophecy of the 14th Dalai Lama, the last. And he just stepped down about a month or so ago as the leader of Tibet, the political leader. He's still the spiritual leader. But I also had this vision. Can you imagine Easter Sunday? Imagine Easter Sunday. The Pope walks out on his balcony and he looks down in St. Peter's Square and he said, "Just want to say one thing. Don't become a Catholic." So here we are at this time of prophecies, and I think it's really important to understand that none of the prophecies say we will achieve this higher level of consciousness. It's not automatic. We have to do it. You have to do it. That's why the twin heroes had to do it. It's not a leader that does it. Our leaders can't do it. Obama can't do it. Sarah Palin, well, can't do it. None of our leaders can do it. We have to understand they're extremely vulnerable, for one thing. Obama's in a very, very, very vulnerable position, and he can't do it. It's a good time to create this change. I just want to take a moment to talk a little bit about how we got here, because I think I have to take a lot of that some of that responsibility. Because we got to this position because people like me, economic hitmen, first truly global empire in the history of the world. It's a corporate empire. It's not a country empire. It's not the United States empire, really. It's a corporate empire. But it was created for the first time in history, an empire created without the military for the most part. And it's happened many different ways, but perhaps the most common that I employed was to identify a country with resources our corporations covet, like oil. Arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations, but the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country. Power plants, industrial parks, highways, things that will benefit a few very wealthy families in that country, as well as our own corporations, the main beneficiaries. But don't help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity, don't have cars to drive on highways, can't get jobs in industrial parks because industrial parks don't hire many people. And yet they're left holding a huge debt that they can't possibly repay. And so at some point we go back and say, hey, since you can't pay your debts, give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies without any environmental restrictions. Let us destroy your rainforests, your deserts, your seas, whatever, your beaches. Vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote. Allow us to build a military plant, a military facility on your lands. Something along these lines. And in the few cases where we economic hitmen fail, the jackals step in. I talk in my books about how I failed with Jaime Roldós, the democratically elected president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos of Panama. I couldn't corrupt them. I couldn't get them to buy into the system. And as a result, they were assassinated by the jackals. The jackals either overthrow governments, as they recently did to Zelaya in Honduras, or they assassinate leaders. They're very much involved in what's going on in the Middle East today. There's an amazing behind-the-scenes story in the Middle East today. Fascinating what's going on there right now. In the few cases where the jackals also fail, as they did with Saddam Hussein, they couldn't take him out. His security was too good. He had too many look-alike doubles. Then the military steps in. So you've got this three-tiered approach. It's primarily done by economic hitmen. If they don't succeed, usually the jackals do. If they don't, then the military goes in. And in this way, we've created this empire. It's a corporate empire. It's driven by the people who run our biggest corporations. This isn't a conspiracy theory, incidentally. These people don't have to get together. They don't even have to know each other. But they control our politicians. Nobody in the United States gets elected to a major office without huge corporate support. We're certainly seeing the fruits of that with the Obama administration. I'm not trying to knock anybody here, but it's well, we're seeing it. We're seeing it all over the world. The corporatocracy controls the mainstream press, either through direct ownership or advertising budgets. They run the world.
I pledge allegiance to the flags of Microsoft and Exxon, and to whichever mega bank AT&T writes checks on. I swell with patriotic pride whene'er I hear them spell MULTINATIONAL. The sovereign nations of this world, we've canceled every one of them. And every race except the French, 'cause it's still fun to make fun of them. The wind is high, the market's bull. Guess that must be the smell of MULTINATIONAL. To war, I'll fight for Rupert Murdoch. But if I should injure Minnie Mouse, I'll bravely cry, save her, Doc. I think of starving multitudes as potential clientele for MULTINATI, you know the rest. Yes, heaven waits for those who service the Coke machine in hell. MULTINATIONAL. Ah, well.
Roy Zimmerman, of course, singing multinational anthem. briefly interrupting the old economic hitman, John Perkins, in the middle of his analysis of how corporations have replaced nation-states as the rulers of the world. With this claim, I agree entirely. Perkins moves on to an optimistic claim that people have the power to transform the corporations and take control of the world. Is that true? Well, listen to him and see what you think. Back to John Perkins.
Through most of my lifetime, you could look at the globe as this, you know, this big ball with roughly 200 countries, of which a few had a lot of power, the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, the United States at different times. Today, you'd better envision that globe surrounded by huge clouds that know no national borders, don't respect any particular sets of laws. These are the big corporations. Strike partnerships and deals with the Chinese, the Taiwanese, and the Tibetans, the Israelis and the Palestinians, the Indians and the Pakistanis, with anybody who has resources they covet or markets. And this is the world that we're living in today, a world that's really moved from several hundred years ago, geopolitics controlled by religious organizations, then governments, now it's corporations. So the question is, what's next? And next has to be us, the realization of the prophecies, the coming together of the eagle and the condor, the Dalai Lama that rises out of a place that doesn't have Buddhism, the prophecy of the 2012, the twin heroes rising up and replacing a brutal dictator with a compassionate leader, a compassionate consciousness. We are at this time to change our consciousness, and we know it's happening. The prophecies are coming true. You know, in about 2000, the indigenous people and we began to get together. That's why books like the ones that I was writing about shamanism never would have sold a copy back in the 70s, probably. Or maybe a few freaks would have bought them, you know. Some people bought Carlos Castaneda, you know. But the fact is, in the late 90s, the mid and late 90s, people became very interested in shamanic cultures, and the shamans opened up. They invited us to their homes. They invited us to their lands. They opened up to us. The prophecies are being realized, but we have to keep pushing this and moving in this direction. And I think one of the good news aspects of this is that an empire that's run by corporations is an empire that we have control over, because these corporations only survive because we all buy their goods and services. And the marketplace is a democracy if we choose to make it such. When I went to school in Boston, I couldn't walk beside the Charles River. It was so polluted. Not anymore. We forced the corporations to clean it up. When I went to university, there was apartheid in South Africa. For the most part, we got rid of it because we boycotted the corporations that supported it. We got them to get rid of aerosol cans, which were destroying the ozone layer, to hire more women and minorities. Recently, to get trans fats out of their foods and antibiotics out of the chickens. We have tremendous power over these corporations. But now it's time that we get the corporations to change a basic premise. Because beginning in the 70s and especially in 1980, when Reagan and Thatcher and Odson and a number of other world leaders embraced the what I call predatory capitalism, which was espoused by Milton Friedman in the Chicago School of Economics, there became one guiding principle for every major corporation in the world. And that principle is that the goal, the only responsibility of business is to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. That was never true when I was in business school. We were not taught that at all. We were taught that a CEO shouldn't even make that much money, decent living, but he or she needed to take care of their employees, their customers, their suppliers, and the community. Be a good citizen. That all changed in the 70s and especially in the 80s. And ever since, every U.S. president has embraced this predatory form of capitalism, Democrat and Republican alike. We need to change that. You need to change that. Don't buy any more from any corporation that has that philosophy. The new philosophy has to be, yes, give a decent rate of return to your investors. I am a capitalist, basically. There may be better systems. I'd like to see one that would come along, but right now I can't identify one, so I'll try to change this one as much as I can. Let's set a new set of rules out there. Establish a new set of rules. Make a decent rate of return. Make profit, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. And don't buy from any corporation that won't do that. And, you know, we have to take a lot of the responsibility because for far too long we've been sending the message. And let's face it, corporations are just people, you know. Well, you know, I've known in my lifetime a lot of CEOs, a lot of people in high management, and I personally don't know one who wants to see Florida sink beneath the oceans. I don't know any that are bad guys. I know there are some. I know Phil Knight down the road here is a sociopath at Nike. Certainly the people at Enron were sociopaths, and there's a lot of on Wall Street that are sociopaths, but there's a lot of people out there that are just receiving a message from you and me, and that message is, give me an expensive shirt, and if that has to be made in a sweatshop in Indonesia or China by slaves, I'll just look the other way. Give me cheap gas for my car. Don't you dare raise the price of gas. And if that means destroying the Amazon rainforest, I'll just look the other way. We've been doing that. And we've got to turn this around. We've got to say no more of that.
John Perkins, author of Shapeshifting, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and most recently, Hoodwinked. www.johnperkins.org. Thanks again to Seattle radio and community TV guy Mike McCormick for making the audio available. You'll find a link to Mike's uncut version, plus lots of other good stuff, on our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. You'll also find there an archive of past installments of this show, available for free listening or downloading. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Illigit my non-carborundum, save the rainforest, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.